The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
More than 40 groups of essential workers are to be prioritised in an emergency fuel rationing plan. These groups will be given access to a network of 130 service stations across the country in the event of a severe shortage. With the Nord Stream 1 pipeline under maintenance and the war in Ukraine still raging, are we likely to return to the fuel crisis of the 1970s, where people queued at the pumps, car-free days were encouraged across Europe? Japan, for example, advised workers to wear short sleeves and no ties to save on the use of air conditioning. And there were lots more innovative ideas at the time. Well, joining me to discuss all of this is David Horgan, the Managing Director of Petrol Resources. David, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, first of all, you're back from your travels. Where have you been?
I was in Bolivia and Australia. In Bolivia, we were developing lithium, which goes into lithium-ion batteries, you know, for EVs and grid storage, and also biofuels, which are, there's increasingly demand for biofuels to blend into natural fuels.
So that should alleviate some of the shortages if fossil fuels typically are to become scarcer. Now, let's talk about what's going on in the market. There's one thing that's writ large, I suppose. We pay for our fuels in dollars, and unfortunately the dollar is strong, the euro is weak.
And that exacerbates the effect of the oil price. And people tend to look at the spot price for crude. So it goes down over the last weeks in Europe, and that looks like good news. But the dollar's risen in the last 2.5 weeks by 5%. You know, so in euro terms, it hasn't changed for us. Also, there's massive intervention by the Biden administration. They've been dumping 1 million barrels of oil a day from strategic petroleum reserves into the market.
In the United States?
Yeah, which is 1% of world supply and 5% of American supply. So it's a big deal. And they're doing that for political reasons, to the point that the reserves in the United States are now at their lowest since 1985. Now, you think what reserve is. It's supposed to be there as a bolt hole, a safety net in an emergency. It's not supposed to be there for politicians to manipulate electoral results.
But that's what they're doing in the United States, to in some way counteract the increases in the cost of living. Try to bring the oil price down, which means at the pump it doesn't go up as much.
Yeah, but if you look at the front page of the Irish Times, we're talking about emergency measures in the winter, and that's when you need your reserves. So, I mean, really, the politicians should show more discipline and longer-term planning. Unfortunately, it's all about the immediate. It's all about the virtue signalling.
Now, talk to me about, we'll go to gas in a moment, but talk to me about the sources of the oil. Who are the biggest producers? Which countries have the capacity to do more?
Well, at the moment, we're consuming about 102 million barrels a day. Of that, about 92 million is crude oil. Then you've got about 6 or 7 natural gas liquids, which are liquids, but they come out of natural gas. And the balance is biofuels, which have been rising over time. And crude is, of that 92 million barrels, about a third or 30 million barrels is OPEC. Before COVID, Russia was about 11.5. Then with the invasion of Ukraine, Russia fell to about 11. And then over the last few months, it's been very chaotic. It fell as much as 3 million barrels a day. But in recent 2 or 3 weeks, just talking to traders, it looks like, to me anyway, it looks like the Russian volumes are back up again. They're down a bit, like 400,000 barrels a day. But basically what's happened is the market has worked once again, and the Russian exports are now moving to the Pacific, particularly to China, the Koreas, and all the new Chinas.
Now, Russia is having to cut its prices, though, is it not, to make it attractive to those countries to buy Russian rather than OPEC oil?
Oh, yeah. In the days after the illegal invasion, they cut their price. There was a big deal with Shell, a $28 discount. They were doing $30 discounts all over the place. But just last week, I was talking to the traders, and they were bemoaning the fact that there still is a discount, but it's down to about $6, $7. And what's happened is the market has worked. It was difficult, and there's lots of costs. And there's lots of screw-ups, like refiners are really under pressure now because they won't get the type of crude that they're best able to handle, most efficiently able to handle. But it looks like the Russians are able to place virtually all their oil now and most of their products, especially diesel.
And they're placing that at a minor discount of $6 or whatever it is, 6%, rather than at the 20% or 30% discount they had to, first of all, employ.
Well, I'll give you an example. I mean, the Bolivians import 24,000 barrels of diesel a day. And we actually looked at, just as a favour to them, we looked at what could you place that and what discount. And basically, a state-to-state deal, they might get $5 or $6 discount. But by the time you take into account, you know, getting a tanker to get, you know, from, it can't go from the Black Sea because of the war, tanker to come from the Baltic and go all the way down to South America, it would have cost them more money than buying it from Argentina. So these are the importance of logistics as well as the initial discount. And if you look at the Pacific, you simply cannot get a berth. If you want a berth anywhere in the Pacific, either in Eastern Russian Federation or neighbouring countries, it's all chock-a-block now with tankers going to East Asia.
Now, before the war in Ukraine, was there a shortage of oil, given the economies were recovering slowly? In the case of China, we had the shutdown in Shanghai and so on, so it wasn't all guns blazing, if you'll pardon the phrase. Was there enough oil being produced to meet the world needs?
The market was in fairly tight balance. It was about, pre-COVID, about 2.5 million barrels a day of surplus capacity. But what was happening is that there wasn't new investment. And the reason why there was a new investment is the last 10 years, you've had this massive wave of petrophobia where institutions were reluctant to have people invest in long-term projects. They said, well, what if it's a stranded asset? So companies were issuing dividends.
What you're saying is, why would I build an oil refinery if we're all going to be going electric in 10 years? I'm left with a white elephant.
Yeah. Now, in the real world, that's not true, of course. First of all, there won't be the rapid decline that is anticipated. And even if there were, you could do things like we're looking at in Bolivia, where you take an existing refinery and you convert it to biofuels. So in the real world, the system is more flexible than you think. But the perception of institutional investors and of shareholders, especially activist groups, is quite different. And managers are forced to go with perception rather than reality. They all know that we're in a business cycle, but when there was a bust, they had to assume bust prices. In a boom, they don't assume boom prices.
Okay, so if the economies were to recover, if the war was to cease, there would really be a problem with the predicted growth of the world economy in servicing that with oil.
Well, that's the situation we're now in, because we're now at higher levels of consumption, both for oil and even for coal, as well as for natural gas, than we were before COVID. So the big untold story is the great boom in Asia. That's what we were looking at in Australia, trying to feed this monster, the Asian monster. And basically, there isn't the pipeline there to supply it. OPEC just yesterday announced that they anticipate 2.7 million barrels of growth a day, which would be the fastest growth since the recovery from the economic crisis. And we just don't have the supplies. They have at most 2 million barrels of surplus capacity, and there just isn't the capacity there. So people go short.
Now, I know you're familiar with both Iran and Iraq. What are the possibilities? In Iran, there are political difficulties for the West in terms of the nuclear deal that Trump collapsed. So those sensitivities are still there. In Iraq, I'm told if you take a bucket and spade, you could find oil just below the surface. There's a lot of it there, but it's not necessarily developed.
Yeah, I mean, the problem in both countries is actually the fiscal terms, the tax terms. Basically, there's an infinity of oil and gas reserves in both countries. Like if you go to Iran and you look at the gas projects, they're not talking about a Korab. They're talking about a minimum 20 Korabs, even 40 Korabs. You know, it's just off the spectrum. But they've structured for historical reasons because of their exploitation by the British and sensitivity, they've structured the contracts in such a way that it's actually not that attractive to companies. Like if you're developing an existing oil or gas field, you've basically got a rate of return of about 13%. Now that might be fine for Switzerland. It's not fine for Iran with all the political and operational and other questions.
You've got to add an extra percentage for risk.
Yeah. Now, everyone in every country, and Ireland is no exception, always thinks that their own country is low risk. But the reality is that the euro is an orphan. It can go anywhere. It doesn't have to go to Iran. It can, you know, make money in the North Sea or Gulf of Mexico or Africa or whatever. And what we've been trying to persuade the Iranians and the Iraqis and the Venezuelans in recent years is that you've got to understand finance and you've got to cut your cloth according to, you know, the needs of the customer.
What are they offering in these countries, in Venezuela, in Iran, in Iraq? Are they offering joint ventures, but basically the state has a very tight grip on things?
In all those three countries, they have variations of service contracts. So effectively what you do is, in the case of Iran, you make the investment as the international company, take all the risk, including all the technological risk, because you're trying to boost recovery from rocks beyond what they could get on their own. And basically, if anything goes wrong, it's to your account. If it goes right, you're bought out after 8 to 10 years. And the rate of return, you know, for exploration might be 17%, for development might be 15%.
So basically, they get the international companies with the expertise to build the resource, get it working, prove its viability, and then they take it.
Basically, yeah. And that's why there isn't the development in new reserves. Now, paradoxically, actually, Ireland had a much more intelligent tax regime. Ireland basically had a regime where you paid a minimum of 29% tax. I'm talking about recent years, and a maximum of 55% tax. And while there were risks in Ireland, deep water, and it was frontier geology, still, that was enough to draw in the major companies. Until, of course, we discovered the green transition, and all the companies were forced to leave.
And I know that's a bugbear of yours, and you've made that point many times. Now, the gas, Nord Stream 2 never was commissioned because there were obviously political and allegedly some other technical difficulties that had to be resolved. Nord Stream 1 was pumping away. Putin reduced the output from that, and now it is shut down for maintenance. And many people in Germany are wondering, will it ever reopen?
Well, what's happening is that the Russians are on to the most severe economic sanctions of any developed economy in history. And what they're doing now is they're dragging their heels and they're acting the maggot, as we would say. But within the law, they've honoured their contracts. There is an override on contracts for safety reasons. And they've said, well, there's an issue, which there is, with this turbine. It needs maintenance. Now, the turbine is a German turbine from Siemens. It could have been repaired in Germany. Instead, it was sent to Canada, naturally. Why was it sent to Canada? Because the Canadians have a large Ukrainian ethnic minority. Justin Trudeau has taken a strong position against Russia over the illegal invasion, and it was deliberately to wind up the Canadians, and it worked because the Canadians allowed the repair to go ahead and the turbine's on its way back. When the turbine's installed, they could go back to the full flow rates. At the moment, they're at 40%. They could produce it more than 40%. It's not the only turbine in the pipeline system. But there's an easy answer to this. We simply have to switch on Nord Stream 2, which is built. It has line pack. It's passed all its safety checks. The only reason why it hasn't flowed is because of the invasion of Ukraine. You could say, okay, for the next few months, we'll fill up our European storage by using Nord Stream 2.
But we've seen that Putin has no hesitation in using his assets, and indeed Ukraine's assets, to bring political pressure to bear on the global economy. I mean, the food problem by not exporting or allowing the export of grain from Ukraine, and now gas is a weapon to bring the German economy to its knees, potentially.
Well, there's no doubt that Putin's quite ruthless, and there's no doubt that the grain and the ensuing hunger, particularly in the poor countries, is a weapon that both sides will use if they can. But at the same time, the exporter of gas from Russia is Gazprom. Gazprom is incredibly scrupulous about obeying the letter of the law. Like, for to give you an example, on the day of the invasion, the European utilities called. Which they can, their options on extra gas, assuming that Gazprom couldn't deliver or wouldn't deliver, and they would get cash, which they would get. Gazprom started to flow the gas where? Through Ukraine. So you had this weird situation that they were killing each other above the surface, and they were flowing gas below the surface to the profit of the Ukrainians, the European customers, and of course Gazprom as an exporter. So the Gazprom exporters will honour the letter of the contract. But we have to, you know, we've got to put
it. But isn't it a
ourselves.
Sort of Damocles that is being held over the German economy?
Well, and it has to work, doesn't it? Because, you know, we're looking here at the front page of the Irish Times talking about prioritised groups. I mean, every group thinks they're prioritised, but Germany is 55% dependent on Russian gas and simply hasn't got alternatives. There's no LNG station. Like Ireland, it's amazing. The Germans, with all their practicality and their experience of conflict, didn't build LNG stations.
And we were talking to a company, Max Mel, they're called, who were talking about delivering LNG and doing it out at sea and pushing it into the Kinsale link. And straight into the grid here. And they're saying it's technically possible. It won't happen overnight, but we could have an LNG terminal out at sea beyond the horizon. No one's bothered by it. If an accident should happen, it's out in the middle of the ocean.
Well, and the Shannon LNG location is perfect because you don't want to put an LNG station on the Atlantic. The Atlantic is very rough, but the Shannon estuary, it's a perfect location. The local politicians support it, local people support it, and it's really only tree huggers that object to it. And it's a no-brainer from Ireland's point of view, but it's not just the treehuggers that have frustrated that project. Also, the regulator has done everything they could to stop it by trying to impose super taxes on the project to effectively subsidise the Bord Gáis pipelines from Scotland, which makes eminent sense for the state sector, but no sense for the Irish consumer.
Now, talk to me about our vulnerability, because the EU, for example, could, if you like, commandeer gas that comes through the UK and over to us. The EU could say, hang on, Germany needs it more. And the pipelines, you know, whoever buys the gas, and the EU could buy the gas and maybe deny us and give it to Germany, even though we're an EU member too.
Well, I mean, for spot volumes, he who pays the premium will get the price. So that would suit us that if we ration as the European Union. What happened in 1980 was that the Germans got almost fully supplied and we were left short because they were prepared to pay the super premium. But our problem is that even if we're part of an EU policy, we're still dependent on Brexit Britain. We're dependent for 75% of our gas, which is rising over time, through Scottish interconnectors. Now, in past interruptions, the Scots actually honoured their contractual arrangement. And talking to people in Moffat, they said, well, look, you're so small, it wasn't worth the hassle of cutting you off. But would Brexit Britain take the same view? I think they'll cut off Ireland before they'll cut off their own industry.
Yeah, I mean, they have said that they would treat us in the same way as they would treat their own domestic customers, but who is to know? And then, of course, where would they cut it off? Because it comes through Northern Ireland.
No, it comes through North County Dublin. There's two interconnectors from Moffat in Scotland, and Northern Ireland is supplied, but it's supplied from the south. We're part of the Northern Ireland grid, both for electricity and for gas. So it comes, there's a couple of very small connectors.
So, I'm just wondering, if they cut us off, then they cut off Northern Ireland off as well.
Now, there's a couple of very small pipelines to Antrim, but the bulk of Northern Ireland's gas actually comes through North County Dublin and is reflowed northwards.
Okay, now some of the questions coming in comments. Ireland could take cattle slurry, put it into an anaerobic digester and create gas that could be pumped into the national grid. It would mean more gas for the consumer and reduce our emissions. It would not be a silver bullet, but it would help. That kind of technology...
Yeah, I mean, when you look at all these projects, even at the biofuels, like you might get... For a hectare, if you're in the tropics, you might get 4 tonnes of vegetable oil, which converts into maybe 2 tonnes of diesel equivalent. But, you know, that's what's that, 12 barrels of oil a year? You know, so the problem is it's the density. It's just, it's more effort logistically than it's worth. Now, if you have a huge pig farm, a big piggery, and you're producing vast amounts of silage and can't dispose of it anywhere else, why not recycle it? But, you know, it's not going to work.
The global scale or the national scale, it's not going to make that much difference.
No.
Have we any offshore oil of our own?
Actually, Ireland is sitting on one of the most exciting frontier provinces. Now, everyone says, well, because we had 40 years of relative failure, that therefore we've no oil. But that's comparing the North Sea with, a barren piece of land. Basically, the big potential in Ireland is the deepwater Atlantic. And until about 15 years ago, there wasn't the technology to drill in more than about 500 metres of water, because it's really pretty rough if you've ever sailed there. And also, the economics weren't that attractive when the oil price was under $60. But now you're talking at, you know, look at the future price. It's like $100 to $90 over 7 or 8 years. And the technology has leapt ahead. It would be a perfect time to develop our own reserves. We really should be self-sufficient, if not an exporter.
We have a large potential for further discoveries and production of gas and oil in our vast exclusive economic zone of 600,000 square kilometres of sea, yet no further drilling or production of hydrocarbons is allowed in Irish waters. Renewables will take years to fully replace carbon. That's someone one of our listeners called Liam, who goes along with you. You will be seen, though, as a lobbyist for the industry, you know, and people would say, well, David Horgan, he would say that, wouldn't he?
Well, you know, I'm known as a straight talker. I've criticised the industry from time to time, including in your studio. Anyone can verify the facts. Ireland imports 100% of its oil, 75% of its gas. The minister isn't signing extensions and permits. So the reality is that we can't become self-sufficient either from renewables, which require backup, for nuclear, because nuclear is banned. So that means coal, imported natural gas or oil.
Okay. Meantime, at the prospect of rationing, you've been reading the report in the Irish Times there, saying, you know, there will be designated sectors which will have access to fuel should rationing come in. Do you have any recollection of the 70s and the...
I remember it well. My mother was a nurse and she didn't get any allocation. But, you know, we'll get back on a bicycle, we'll lose a bit of weight. It was a miserable time. I don't know if you remember. It was a miserable time. A lot of people, especially older people, went to bed early. They switched off the fire. We don't want to go back to those days. You know, we talk about heat stroke, but 10 times as many people die from cold as heat.
All right. So we have to be more, maybe less political and more practical. Is that your message?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with wanting to reduce emissions, but our overriding priority is affordable, reliable energy for your listeners.
Last question, and two comments that relate to each other. Green biofuels, 100% diesel replacement without any engine modifications, a great alternative. Another one, hydro-treated vegetable oil, 90% carbon neutral. Why not use it? Many oil distributors in Dublin have it.
Well, that's what we're doing in Bolivia. But if you do an honest audit, it's not 90% less carbon. It's marginally less because you need fertilizers, land clearing. There's all sorts of impacts. So you have to get audited. Yeah, and the auditors, they'll probably give you like 60, 70%. They won't give you 90%. But your basic problem is, even in the tropics, the yield is just relatively small. Like the highest yield I've ever seen is maybe 20 tons per hectare using African palm in Southeast Asia. But then you have the problems of monoculture and a backlash from local communities. You know, it's not a silver bullet, but there is a future for biofuels.
All right. Well, we're all being a bit simplistic, perhaps, but not you, David. David Horgan of Petrel Resources. David, thank you very much for joining us in studio today.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.